calling them attractions, and how singularly unattractive they were, and how actually amusement parks are unattractive too. You know, I remember the only time I've ever been to Euro Disney, you know, throwing my son's pushchair at the father of my son, because we had a row within moments of being in there, because it was so ghastly. And as I went to the gate, they said, I want a stamp so I could come back? And I turned to this poor person, why would I want to come back? And he looked really, really shocked, because it was meant to be a wonderful thing, and yet it's a terrible thing. So even the things that are supposed to be attractions are unattractive, and yours are even fundamentally more unattractive, because they expose the real hell of attraction.
I think I prefer hell.
You prefer
attraction. No, but we know hell has interested artists for a hell of a long time, don't we? I mean, it's where all the excesses and opposites can kind of coexist. It's where the most vibrant, I don't know, I mean, honestly, you know, that's visually, at least, attractive. I have an artist friend with whom we've talked about hell for a long time as an image. Hell and loses heaven.
I was interested that you mentioned Kafka.
Yeah.
Because it struck me this summer while I was rereading some about how there's all these kind of interpretations of Kafka, and they all kind of fit, and they're all kind of wrong as well. Like there's a bureaucratic Kafka, an ex-Marxist, anti-bureaucratic. You could even reread The Trial now as he's a banker who gets executed. Brilliant. He's not the hero, he's actually the villain of the piece, and it sort of fits. And I just wondered if the kind of the thing about your work is kind of you can look at it and you go, it's sculpture, no it's not. Oh it's relational, oh no it's not. It's process, it's not. And it kind of it continually resists a categorization. And I wonder, I mean I'm just drawing out a simple parallel, but no, which I think is and I like the way that you kind of work. Is it the document? Is it the document? Is it the structure you build? Is it the time of building? And I don't know. Maybe you're not interested in pinning it down. But I think it's fascinating that you kind of draw a parallel with the one writer who's infinitely malleable in some respects.
Yeah, I think it's, it's because I've felt some kind of similarities in terms of that. I don't know if it's a confusion or an impossibility. I mean, I know often when I'm doing a work, I tell myself if I were writing a book right now, I would be like writing four or five books on top of each other at the same time, because there's so much you want to say with each work, and so the only way to allow that is to not develop it to the point where it says too much.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I suppose that's the way fables fables work and tales work, because the writer plays with that. And I think that's how Kafka's stories work. Why is it we can reread Kafka? We never get tired of it. I mean, we can always read it differently, because it's a kind of plan for, I think it has to do with the nature of the spaces it draws out, and then the way things are formulated. I don't know how to describe it.
Well, there's a tension in the work, and do chip in if anyone wants, with this kind of idea of resolution and change. Like each of the shops the shops, for instance, seem resolved, and then no sooner do they exist as they don't exist, but then they kind of morph into something else, which is just as resolved.
Yeah.
And then it resolves itself into a series of photographs, which becomes another thing. And that kind of holding that tension between it's you've made it, you've worked in public, but you're kind of working privately because there isn't a big audience.
Yeah,
but but when the public come in, they're kind of not really it's not the thing just sort of exists without them anyway. But then the public are kind of they look like they should be invited. It's a kind of version of a theme park, or it's a kind of shop, or it's a kind of souvenir shop or something.
Yeah.
But it isn't really sort of set up properly for that.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of like you don't even want them to sit on the chairs if you can, but you can't, you don't feel you have enough agency to say, don't sit on the chairs. which is interesting because you don't, you sort of want control and then abdicate somewhere.
Well, I told the girl who runs the space to tell people to get off the chairs when they sit on.
Oh right, okay. So there is a. But you're saying you can't stop them, but you can stop.
That's
them.
That's terrible.
But you can stop them continuing.
That's so cruel, isn't it? Because it's really immediately punishes the person. The person sits down because they think you can sit down.
No,
but then they're told they can't.
No,
so they've committed a crime.
That's the thing. No, they haven't. But I mean, when you it's hard to photograph. But when you see, when I see the space, it's occupied. There's only chairs and flat screen-like things on the wall. But for me, that space is inhabited. There's a level of concentration happening. And that's like a real, like just a sculptural thing that
so
surprised me. It's something that happened. I said, so for me, it's not a question of can I sit down? It's like, why would I wouldn't sit down. It would be like sitting on somebody.
Right.
So people obviously, well, why can't we sit down? So it's a way to start a conversation too. I said, well, what are you expecting to sit down? Maybe you will see things in the screens.
Can I just ask about the relation with work and labor? Because there's something about this use of the space that is kind of, Brian was sort of touching on this idea of the kind of semi-public, semi-private kind of relation. It's both a kind of studio space and it's a space that's available as an exhibition space for the public. But, you know, the way you use the space is very much like that's the space for the production of the work. And I'm kind of interested in that idea of the kind of labor always, in those two works, the In and Out Business and the Promise Park anyway, the labor takes place in the site, which kind of pushes the audience out to a certain extent, I think, but also kind of you talk about being the work being kind of alive or the image coming into existence. You're talking about the camera obscura and the kind of gallery space being a space for the image to come into focus.
Yeah, it's like you're developing a processing an image over a certain amount of time. Regarding the idea about pushing the audience out, or maybe it redefines, or it's looking for a way to redefine the audience. Who gets the big picture? One of the questions that kind of comes up now and again. Like, is it the person who walks in?
It made me think of that quite, this is kind of like an obvious traditional model, but it made me think of like some of Robert Smithson's work, you know, the site, non-site.
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously allusions to that way of working or
but
like
there's a constant disappointment with that you're always like in the wrong place, you know, that somehow the work's existing elsewhere, which is kind of frustration, but also,
Don't we always decide when we let someone into our world and our work? It's just kind of highlighted because you've used the gallery space as a private space of working. I mean, don't we always choose when and if someone, you know, if we invite them into our world? I don't know. I don't find it so unusual, except perhaps it's just highlighted because of the space you choose. I don't know.
Maybe. I mean, I think there's something in the relation to the audience that I'm not quite able to articulate yet, but there might be implicitly it is kind of saying it's happening somewhere else better.
But is it also like we
I run a gallery called Sight Gallery. So I've been
I stopped by.
You went there today.
Had a quick look, yeah.
The word sight, and we think about that a lot, obviously, because it's part of our identity, but and off-site, on-site, no-site, you know, what that means to sort of work with that word. But also one of the programs that we run is called Platform Program, where an artist is invited to take on the gallery as a production space, and the audience is invited to witness some of the production, but also to attend closing event or events that the artist puts on. So it becomes somewhere between an artist studio space and a public gallery space. And it's actually quite an awkward piece of programming to run in many ways, because people dip in at different times within the process, and how you give them access to either some sense of a narrative or an intention, or also things change along the way. It's an amazing thing for the institution to run, and for, you know, some people love it and they come in regularly and watch the whole process unfold, but some people might attend one thing, have a strange experience, and I wonder, you know, how, what that meant for them. And that's, again, you talked about experience in sort of a digital environment, but in an arts environment as well. So to draw my rambling to a close, what I was thinking about in that is, there's also a space of resistance in terms of public space at the moment. I don't know if anybody read Dave Hickey's essay at the weekend about how he's quitting the art world, that was in The Observer. And it's really about this, the sense that this, the art world that we're operating in has become so connected to private wealth in a way that's incredibly uncomfortable. And incredibly implicating on decision making at lots of different levels.
Lobbying.
You know, something like the Tate only gets 30% public funding now because it's it's, and that's not unusual.
Right.
And so I think there's something quite interesting about the problems that that creates for how semi-public, semi-private spaces might operate. And I wonder if there's an element of resistance in that, in your work, in creating something that is unresolved, changing, and it either invites an engagement with something that is unfolding, which sort of demands something of an audience in a different way, to not just consume something in an instant and then walk away and then consume something else like you do in a shop.
Yeah, absolutely. Beginning with the what you term the private experience, it's different from like working in your studio, because even when it's private or semi-closed, there are still people there who are running the space and whom you're dealing with, whom you're negotiating maybe to do something. You have to convince them and then work around them, and maybe, you know, getting, using their tools or their material, having them help you, and then they're asking you also to, you know, turn in certain documents and stuff. So, I mean, there are different audiences at different times. But yeah, I didn't know David Hickey was quitting. That'd be great if, like, lots of people just said, "Oh, we're so bored with this thing, we're all going home." Yeah, resistance, or just kind of chasing after some kind of very vague feeling of something that feels vaguely good. Like, in I can't help myself from always talking about Korosmaki, because when I saw A Man Without a Past, that for me was like a kind of vision of, I didn't see that as it was like a vision of a good future. I said, these people are, they are actually living, they are exchanging, they are communicating. And I think that's what he wants to say in a way. You know, what do they have less than, you know, those celebrities that will be at such and such gala opening? And it's not a new vision. I'm a big Fall fan, and there's always a song that goes through my head called Step Sideways, where I think he, at a certain point, he mutters, who wants to be a celebrity anyway? But that seems to be also one of the dominant models, you know? That's like what the screen offers to kids. Like, I mean, it's enough to see all those little kids running around dressed like, you know, Courtney Love or whatever.
To pick a celebrity at random.
I
was going to ask you about kind of some of the more kind of surface qualities, if we've got time. I like the fact that often the material quality of the work is kind of sufficient and not a lot more than that.
Yeah.
And that seems like, I know you said there, you haven't got a style, but you've got a sensibility. Yeah. There kind of is a sort of, sort of a make-do. A make-do aesthetic.
Oh, make-do, you know, make-do, yeah.
Which it seems...
piecemeal, kind of, yeah.
You know, what's available, you know.
Yeah, well, that helps, you know, the long kind of weeding out process. I mean, the older stuff up to 2005 was kind of insincere about the forms it used. It used them out of convenience, but all these questions about, like, which color and stuff like that, I wanted to, yeah, not be spending so much time with those questions and get more to. Mm-hmm. So, like, we use what we find.
Because I mean, another way to read the work seems to be a way of thinking about a conversation with material. This constant, you know, how you make materials do things, and that's another thing that runs through it.
There's another quote I like by Gregor Schneider, which is doing is a higher form of thinking. And I think, you know, you can think things through to a certain point, and then you're still in the realm of the idea, and you always have to have some kind of material thing
which then
to take that.
And the material pushes back as well.
And then the material resists, or reality resists, you know. And so you adjust, and then that's where it gets interesting, and that's where it becomes possible, because you're adjusting and.
Mm-hmm.
What happened to the guinea pigs?
They reproduced, and then.
That's what I'd heard.
They were creative.
And then we give them to people who wanted guinea pigs. A lot of people who want guinea pigs. People with children, usually. Yeah, yeah.
Anybody else? So we're probably winding up because we've got 6 o'clock. Anybody? It's been quite, it's been us, basically. Anybody?
There is a question I haven't quite formulated properly, leading on from that last thing you were saying about not wanting to be engaged in some questions or interruptions of aesthetics, what colour should it be? And then you put the material together and there's an energy drives that manufacture. But yeah, I still come back to thinking that when you actually put it back into the public realm, you do re-engage some notion of a particular aesthetic. We couldn't see the postcards close up, scrutinised, but the whole notion of having the very nice shelving, the little postcards on, and I just have an image of the beautifully laid out skate park and the room piece with a fabulous piece of architecture, but then it's set in a very lovely, you know, formal.
It's not adequate.
Good enough.
Good enough, okay,
yeah.
Well.
Yeah. Good enough, yeah. Which I think is different.
It's not slick, you know.
In a way that you, appear to throw out in the, frenzy of.
No, it's no
developing ideas, yeah. And then just something curious there between those two.
I like straight lines. I mean, but it's not. Yeah, it's not like a Thomas Hirshhorn kind of mess. I think it's the idea of just finding the minimum. But the thing about the elegance, I don't choose the spaces, like the last space I exhibited in, that's the space they had. The most elegant space is the one I condemned because it just bothered me, because it was, it imposed a logic that I couldn't deal with in that amount of time.
But in you condemned it, but you also opened it as a world of possibilities.
It was to open it, right, to use it in order to open it. Now, the other thing is, the public realm is sticky for me. I'm still trying to define it. You know, who is the public realm at what point? What is a public? Can we still, you know, when we, because the public realm has become so invested with, well, if we speak of public sculpture, you know, often that's already something much more official than what I imagine many of us have in mind when we speak the word public. So what do we mean? You know, who is this public now that we're living in countries which, some of which are still able to conceive of themselves as nations, but which are inhabited less by a people than by a population, populations, right? I mean, I'm thinking especially of continental Europe, even in a place like France, even if politicians will utter the word nation. No, we're in a state, we have a population, populations, different origins. What common ground? What possibility to construct that public space? But regarding your question, when it's... I like it when it's just kind of... I like it for it to be sketchy, but, you know, like a clear drawing, so...
I understand that. I'm just curious to hear you talk about what is in the back of my head. Yeah. It's just niggling away. But to just like sideline that, I was following on from your response, interested that you talked about a slight disappointment with the public, you know, that they would, and I see your point, come in and so misunderstand the work as to sit in your chair, you know. You did express it as a disappointment that how could you do that? How could you just get it so wrong?
Well,
to think
only
you would sit in
two
chair?
Two out of like 200.
I know, but you're
yeah. But of course, yeah.
The public,
yeah.
You're thinking, well, the public didn't come up to much there. Those two. So
because my impression was they were looking for interaction, as though the secret lay with interaction. And so, what do we mean by interaction? And sitting in the chair in that case didn't seem like interaction. Although I won't deny the possibility that, yeah, some will. Maybe are they? I don't know. To me, it didn't make sense because I had grown attached to the work. Maybe next week it will seem normal that there won't be anybody in the chair anymore.
Look, this sounds really banal, really stupid. I'm going to say it anyway. I'm a bit embarrassed to say. But what if a cat came in and sat on the chair? Would the gallery assistant have to get the cat out, or would that be okay?
Oh, that's a good question, actually. Maybe the difference is the cat wouldn't be sitting on the chair to look at, like with it.
Look at art.
To look at the wall and turn the doormat into something other than the doormat.
You won't sit down feeling like it will complete the work.
You can't command cats.
The cat wouldn't be the audience. The
cat won't sit there with the idea that it has to be in that chair to complete that piece of work. Mm.
It's a trick question. You have to think about that.
But how do we know what cats think? Very smart. Yeah.
If it goes to sleep, I suppose. If it's that bolt upright, staring at
No, we'd probably chase...
Yeah, that would be really fucking spooky, wouldn't
it? I would chase
the cat in
each chair.
If you go in and there's a cat and the one in each chair and they're all looking at these, you know.
No, you'd have to chase...
Yeah, and they're nodding to each other.
Like an abstract art.
The problem is if...
Give it a bit.
No, we would chase it off.
You'd chase it off. You would chase it off.
Because if there's a cat in one chair and then a human...
Every cat will want to sit in.
Says, why is there a cat in one chair and not in the others?
So
that becomes
the human presence, the human audio viewer coming in would see the cat then as nothing more than part of the work. And so the catness, the subjectivity, the subjecthood of the cat would be lost.